case, which, well, it's on page 929 of this article. Pretty shocking case. The situation is that there's a legal shield for unethical medical business practices that insurance companies and their derivatives have. So whereas you can sue a doctor for malpractice, you can't sue an HMO for malpractice. So here's the case. One example is the case of a middle-aged man who sustained a large myocardial infarction in a Midwestern city. In the recovery period based on inducible ventricular tachycardia, which placed the patient at high risk for sudden death, his cardiologist determined that the patient required electrophysiologically guided left ventricular aneurysmectomy. Okay. So he needed some heart surgery to be done. But because the local hospitals did not perform this procedure, the cardiologist concluded that his patient's best chance for survival lay in referral to the Barnes Hospital in St. Louis. The surgeons were contacted and arrangements were made for his surgery. Because St. Louis lay outside its service area, however, Lincoln National Health Plan refused to pre-certify payment. After a substantial delay, a second plan-retained cardiologist evaluated the patient. This consultant agreed that the patient should be transferred to Barnes 4 months after the original recommendation. In that period, however, his cardiac function had further deteriorated, precluding the possibility of surgical repair. He was put on a cardiac transplantation list, but died 3 months later while awaiting a suitable heart. The patient's family sued. The court held that when the proposed surgery was canceled in response to the Lincoln National refusal to certify payment, it was not providing the patient with medical advice, and therefore could not be held liable for medical malpractice.
So what would they do?
The insurance company
was saying we won't
making
pay. They were just saying
all that they did was saying that they won't pay. The fact that they won't pay caused this guy's death, and that it was clearly a negligent act, an act which caused the patient's death, but it was made on a purely rule-based decision, and it took 4 months to get a second opinion which approved of the procedure, and the guy died in the meantime. Didn't cause the insurance company to be liable, or the HMO to be liable.
It's a comparatively old case. It's a 5-year-old decision.
Right. You know this decision before?
Reference. I mean, the direction of the law is in the other way. It's
now.
Yeah.
Now, but as I'm saying, the whole situation is relatively unstable. And I think that a good formulation of a desirable point of view, which reflects, I think, many of the major religions, is the one that's given by Cardinal Bernardin, which is quoted on page 926. So this is also 3 years old, or 2.5 years old. He says that the covenant between the doctor and patient is grounded in the moral obligations that arise from the nature of the doctor-patient relationship. They are moral obligations as opposed to legal or contractual obligations, because they are based on the fundamental human concepts of right and wrong. While it is not currently fashionable to think of medicine in terms of morality, morality is, in fact, the core of a doctor-patient relationship and the foundation of the medical profession. Why do I insist on a moral model as opposed to the economic and contractual models now in vogue? Allow me to describe 4 key aspects of medicine that give it a moral status and establish a covenantal relationship. First, the reliance of the patient on the doctor. Illness compels a patient to place his or her fate in the hands of the doctor. A patient relies not only on the technical competence of a doctor, but also on his and her moral compass. on the doctor's commitment to put the interests of the patient first. Second, the holistic character of medical decisions. A physician is a scientist and a clinician, but as a doctor is and must be more. A doctor is and must be a caretaker of a patient's person, integrating medical realities into the whole of the patient's life. A patient looks to his or her doctor as a professional advisor, a guide through some of life's most difficult journey. Third, the social investment in medicine. The power of modern medicine of each and every doctor is the result of centuries of science, clinical trials, and public and private investments. Above all, medical science has succeeded because of the faith of the people in medicine and in doctors. This faith creates a social debt and is the basis of medicine's call, its vocation to serve the common good. Fourth, the personal commitments of doctors. The relationship which a patient creates with a patient creates an immediate, personal, non-transferable fiduciary responsibility to protect that patient's best interests. Regardless of markets, government programs, or network managers, patients depend on doctors for personal commitment and for advocacy through an increasingly complex and impersonal system. This moral center of the doctor-patient relationship is the very essence of being a doctor. It also defines the outlines of the covenant that exists between physicians and their patients, their profession, and their society. The covenant is a promise that the profession makes, a solemn promise, that it is and will remain true to its moral center. In individual terms, the covenant is the basis on which patients trust their doctors. In social terms, the covenant is the grounds for the public's continued respect and reliance on the profession of medicine. I don't think we can disagree with any of these principles, which I think are reasonable guidelines. You seem to have your doubts.
I think he's talking more about the general...
Because of the monetary aspect involved, the hospital could have decided we would take the patient, operate on him, because presumably in the end they'll be paid. They didn't. So is there moral blame to be attached to them?
Of course. I'm not saying that the moral blame is not to be equally divided between the HMO and the hospital. What I'm saying is that the legal system, as it was 5 years ago, was completely cracked in that nobody was forced to take responsibility for a very bad decision. Okay?
That's good. I don't know if this is right. I mean, as a layman, who doesn't have a right to say this. This sounds like it refers mostly to a general practitioner or a family doctor, whereas with dealing most cases, like here's a cardiologist or the decision to operate on the heart, is just an outside doctor that's his specialty. There's no relationship between the patient.
Well, we have two doctors at the table. We'll let them respond to that.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. I mean, the cardinal sounds very much like he's dealing with a real family doctor who has a moral responsibility.
No, but the
patient's care.
Yeah, cardiologist obviously took responsibility for his decision to save the work he thought could make the difference between life and death. So that's a pretty possible answer. There's a lot of things that aren't answered. It doesn't say that the patient refused to be on the phone, just at the hospital. I mean, there's a lot of.
Right.
Well, it used to be when a patient heard no, his assumption was, no, I don't need it. Now, when a patient hears no, the patient has to figure out, does that mean I don't need it, or does that mean you won't pay for it? That's what it comes down to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the cardinal's talking about the general relationship between the patient and as an ongoing thing where he has a responsibility.
Not necessarily.
Well, as a doctor of a patient, can I say that one does have a relationship with one's ex-cardiologist?
Yeah.
Except that one can call up and get a deposit
of
Shiloh's 1,500 miles away.
But the difficulty in today's world is that the mechanisms of medical care that have evolved and are still evolving all work towards weakening that relationship, that responsibility of the doctor for the patient, that reliance of the patient on a particular doctor or group of doctors. And every new directive that comes down because of the economics of healthcare further loosens that bond. I think the real challenge in today's world of medicine is to try somehow to hold on to that bond relationship with somebody where the buck stops, where somebody is primarily there as the person who is caring for the patient, first and foremost, and the rest of the system. And that gets to be very, very difficult. I don't know if you want to.
Yeah, I want to have some.
But you know, in this circumstance, you can join, let's say, any HMO, HMOX. HMOX lists a group of practitioners. They tell the patient who joined them, you can choose anybody on this list who you wish. They care. Okay? Same HMO notifies doctors that as of January 1, 1997, your system, your hospital, your group will be capitated. Capitated means that per year, per patient, we will give you a certain amount of money. You are expected to take care of all the needs of all those patients for the amount of money we've given. Okay? So that patient coming to me who has had his or her, let's say, something basic, like eye care, performed for the past 20 years at the Mass Eye and Ear Infirmary, they don't happen to be within this HMO's purview. If that patient is a capitated patient in my group of patients and chooses to see his or her physician at the Mass Eye and Ear, essentially I wind up paying for that visit.
What do you mean you wind up paying?
Well, because my system of referral, which has its own ophthalmologist, which this patient hasn't worked with before, you know, my referral, if I'm doing it according to the current system, should be to one of those ophthalmologists.
And if you refer to another ophthalmologist, who gets
then
the bill?
The bill gets sent to us because we can pay in advance per patient for that year's care.
Can you force the patient to go to the person that
Well,
that's not the patient's interest if he's been going.
Exactly. It's a very duplicitous system. Insurance company says to the patient, as long as Dr. So-and-so is on our list, you can go to him. It may be an obstetrician who she has seen for the first three births, okay, but it was in a different circle of referral doctors than the one that I belong to. If I'm her primary care physician and she wishes to see her other ophthalmologist, essentially my group, from its cache of funds that this HMO has sent us, has to pay the other group's HMO.
Is that a moral issue or is that an issue of convenience? Why not have the patient establish a
relationship? Well, it's a moral issue in the sense that
it's a moral issue because if I'm
puts him in the middle.
Puts me in the middle. It makes me the fall guy saying to the patient, you know, I would prefer that you didn't go to Dr. X, who may be just as good, if not better, than Dr. Y, who's in my group. Why? Not because you'll get less good care with Dr. X, but because ultimately my group is going to wind up having to pay out of pocket to Dr. X, and whereas we within the group will have certain reductions in cost to try and make it cost effective for our group, some other group is not going to give us a preferential rate for the same care. So essentially what the insurance companies, what the business interests, what the congressional people who approve it all have done is made the doctor schizophrenic. On the one hand, you are supposed to be primarily interested in your patient. On the other hand, you want to come out at the end of the year not having to pay money out of your pocket to the insurance company to balance the book. And that's unfortunately the way medical care is today. Mm-hmm. Getting your patients.
But isn't there a balance because some other patient from some other group could come to be referred to one year?
That's right. And then at the end of the year, you get a nice listing of the tens of thousands of dollars of what the people in charge of your coffers, your budget, say they call quote-unquote leakage, meaning these are people who we should have cared for here who've gone out to other groups, whether by dint of being called to an emergency room in the middle of the night, you know, outside of Boston, or having to have emergency appendectomy in San Francisco. But whatever it is, we wind up paying for it because of the current system of insurance.
But there should be another list of those who pay you because you've taken care of their patients.
So according to the insurance companies, it should balance off. As far as we're concerned, if we're faced with the individual patient across the table and the choices for this back pain, do you do an MRI, which costs the system $1,000, or do you do a spine x-ray, which may be worthless, So it would cost the system $75. You're left trying to make that determination primarily in the patient's interest. As I say, it can easily turn to schizophrenia. You know, I like to think that because I'm an old timer and, you know, these things don't really cut into my career anymore, because I'm essentially, you know, close to retirement age, that I can get along with taking care of patients the way I have for the past 30 years. And when they come after me, tell them the hell with it and throw in the towel and quit. But the young ones come in out of school now who are being trained in this system who will know no other way and will not have any latitude to permit any other way. So I'm more concerned about being a patient 10 years from now than I am about being a doctor.
Yeah. No, it's...
I mean, that's clearly what's
going on here. And these are... The whole situation is completely in flux, as far as I can tell. You know, the ethical and moral problems that you raise will look even more different in 4 or 5 years than they do today.
And you can tell it's starting to get in, or you just starting to see it in the political system. On the Senate floor today, they're making a drive through a second bill. You see it in state legislatures, because it's refusing to allow, mandating to HMOs may not discharge maternity patients after all the data. You know, one specific politically sympathetic example of getting instant political.
Yeah, but remember that political decisions usually are the worst. I mean,
but what I'm saying is my point is not that these are rational decisions, it's but that the issue is starting to really resonate with the population. This instability is starting to be something.
Well, I mean, for example, I mean we've mentioned this several times. Classical case of people getting the worked up over an issue and therefore the government entering and trying to make things equitable was the issue of the kidney machines, right? I mean, the dialysis machines. At the beginning, when the dialysis machines existed, the individual hospitals had to do triage because there was so few of them. So this was considered absolutely immoral because the doctors were deciding on the basis of, and it was a really severe moral question. I mean, this one, we're talking going back to about 1970, correct me on my dates, but approximately then is where the dialysis machines came into effect, and they were extremely expensive, and the doctors would make a decision on whom to save and whom not to save on some complicated basis, some of which age-related, health-related, and so on, and therefore Congress intervened in this, saying that it was absolutely immoral for doctors to decide who's going to live and who's going to die on the basis of the non-availability of funds for these machines. So they said that anybody who had to have a dialysis treatment automatically was entitled to Medicare, right? This was sort of an amendment to the Medicare deal, which had the undesirable effect that everybody who normally would die of kidney failure in the course of a normal procedure of death goes on to the kidney machines. So now what has happened as a result of this attempt by Congress to legislate on the basis of pure morality has put us into a horrible situation where people who would normally die, I mean, you know, what do you die of? Correctly, with the two doctors here, I feel incompetent in talking, but I mean, you die of kidney failure or pneumonia or something like that, and those normal causes of death have sort of been eliminated because the people are hooked up to machines. So people just can't die anymore in any natural way. So here's a situation, am I saying something incorrect?
What do you mean by dying in a natural way?
Well, people are normally attached to a dialysis machine if they're at their end of life stage for the effect of prolonging of life. In the old days, when the dialysis machine came out, it was for someone who specifically had acute kidney failure as a primary illness or as a result of some traumatic injury. Now the dialysis machine is used as a routine in the treatment of patients who are terminal.
It's not quite routine. I think when a patient goes on dialysis, there are extensive conversations with the person himself or herself, with the family. The goals are elucidated if it's somebody who's a potentially good candidate for ultimately for a kidney transplant, then the decision tends to be made to go on dialysis as a temporizing.
No, but suppose someone, you know, goes into kidney failure as a result of a terminal illness in a hospital. What happens?
You know, most of the time when I've been involved, we caution against it. Generally, the patient and the family agree not to do it, mm-hmm. because it does involve a substantial amount of manpower and activity and cost. And the feeling is that, you know, it's stupid. It's not fun.
And intubation?
Same with intubation. In that respect, the hospitals and the profession have largely, at least in, you know, the urban areas, have largely caught up with the moral issues and the dilemmas. I think there's just a lot of experience, and mm-hmm. unhappy experience. So
I'm about 4 or 5 years out of date.
Well, but, you know, as you say, there's a flux. There are parts of the country where, you know, that hasn't reached this. In most big city hospitals, and I would like to think in most socioeconomic groups, although I suspect there's a lot more democracy in the upper classes, those who can afford to pay and have insurance than those who are on the dole. I don't know, but I haven't worked in a city hospital in many years recently. But I would suspect that it's a fairly even structure as to how the dialysis management is offered.
Mm-hmm.
Many patients now can do it from home. The technology has improved such that you don't need dialysis centers anymore. Many people have their own living device at home. And it's all that it is. You have an assistant there to help you read that. So it's almost,
yeah, but I mean, you're talking about a person who has a specific kidney disease as opposed to a person who has kidney failure as a
in general, and
who's generally healthy.
Severe advanced disease and is not apt to live for other reasons anyway, we try to avoid putting that in there.
Mm-hmm. But that wasn't the case 4 or 5 years ago, if I recall.
You know,
things have improved.
Just sophistication with knowledge, I think, by and large, you find that you can't prolong the life enough anyway, or the quality of life enough anyway.
Mm-hmm.
That's determined by the patient, the patient's family, the patient's family.
Okay. Time is running out a bit. I would like to do the following. Maybe I should. There, at the end of, well, there are two things I would like to do. One, there are two halakhic issues. One is the issue of risky operations. We've discussed this in the past, and maybe we should review this again next week, but there's the sources here are the Shuvah B'Shavus Yaakov, מרופאי מומחה על חולה אחד שחלה את חליוך שקרוב למות בו, וכל הרופאים עומדים שוודאי ימות תוך יום או יומיים, אך שעומדים שיש עוד רפואה אחת שישר שיתרפא מחוליו, וגם אפשר להפך, שמכך רפואה זו אינו תצליח אחת ושלום ימות מיד, תוך שעה או שעתיים, אם מותר לעשות את זה, או חיישינו לחיי שעה ושבע על תעשה עדיף. Shuvah of the Shavus Yaakov, who decides that one is allowed to undergo a dangerous procedure, which is quite likely to result in death, if there's some chance that it will prolong life when you're dealing with a patient for whom, if there was no procedure, death was imminent. On that, we also had the
colon.
Hmm? Huh? Yes. We had in that regard also, there was a tshuva of Rabbi Yaakov Atlinger, which I didn't read for Zeus, and then there was also the tshuva of Chaim Ozer on the same issue, with Vahashayla Shasha'al Mahal Kumarko Toto, Bacholev Arochim Hamunchim Omunki, Belo Apoi Vaporation, Lo Yehe Yotel Mishisha Hadashim. ועל ידי ניתוח קשה שיחיה אך הניתוח מסוכן מאוד, בקרוב יותר שימות מהרה. that it's a risky operation, say, שוב ראיתי שכן הוא בשבות יעקב סימן ע"ה ובפתחי תשובה יודע סימן של ל"ט ובגיליון הרשש סימן של ל"ו וכן הוא בתשובת בניין ציון כאו וביא לארגון רב יעקב אטליגר ובתפארת ישראל ביומה והסברה פשוטה דאין חילוק בין חיי שעה לזמן מועט של יום או יומיים או איזה חדשים. By extrapolation, where do you draw the line? But basically his opinion is that one is allowed to undergo a dangerous procedure if one has to balance definite death within a finite and reasonably short period of time, as opposed to an even risky operation where the issue is one of where you might actually die. And on that we have a discussion in the Igos Moshe, which I will take up with you next week as well. Let me go over two other short items on the issue of suicide, which we again discussed at length a couple of years ago, but there are several items which we may or may not have discussed. So on my 5-1, יש לתנועה מדוע ציווה דוד להרגו ויאמר אליו דוד איך לא יראית לשלוח ידך etc etc. The Ralbag asks why was this messenger condemned to death והנה עשה זה ברצון שאול לבקשתו. After all, he just followed Shaul's instructions. אלא שהתשובה בזה איננה ממה שיקשה, it's not a difficult answer, וזה שאומר לחברו חבול בי, וחבל בו, כמו שדבר בגמרא, כל שכן בהמתת המלך. Since one, if I ask somebody else to injure me, and he does, the person is still guilty, certainly when it's a question of the killing of a king. ואין מצוות המלך ממה שתפתול בזה, כי דברי הרב ודברי תלמיד דברי מי שומעים. If the king tells you to do something, but God tells you not to commit murder, you're supposed to listen to him. Vehinei hezhira Torah al yedei ha-hamata. Kol shekein al hamatat hamlachim. So the Ralbag derives from this, and then he tried to derive from this Ralbag, that assisted suicide in any form is definitely prohibited. Active intervention which results in assisted suicide is definitely prohibited. On the other hand, indirect forms of suicide, the Gemara, we mentioned some case before, Tanya, in my next page, he luz shetzovim bat chelet, he luz shebasan chelet v'lo bilbala, v'chadnetze v'lo hechuta, ve'af malach hamavet ein lo reshut la'avor ba. The Malach HaMavet can't enter into this magical town of Luz. Elos kelim sheva bezman shedaatam katsa aleihem yotzin chutz l'chomah v'hem eitim. The old people in this town, when they get fed up with life, they don't kill themselves exactly, but they go out of town where the Malach HaMavet is available and they die. So therefore, at least the principle of being able to take an indirect step of not living in this walled town which consists of a Shangri-La of perpetual life is a morally acceptable according to this Gemara. And so the Eskimos put the guy, old people, on a raft, and that's deliberately killing them. Here it's not clear that the Malach HaMavet is going to immediately seize this old person the moment he steps out of town. He's just avoiding the magical protection of the town by going out.
Can now, we infer that the life is artificially prolonged?
Right? Exactly. Life is artificially prolonged in this town because of the fact that the Malach HaMavet is not allowed to enter, and under those circumstances, when a man gets old enough and fed up with life, he's allowed to remove this artificial prolongation. Okay. On the other hand, people who actively take their lives, of course, even person who commits suicide in the case of pain and suffering is certainly not allowed, and doctor-assisted suicide, if the doctor actively intervenes, is murder. Let me just keep it up here. Endless thing issues which I don't completely understand. Maybe Dr. Schwaber, I can put you slightly to work for next week.
As long as they're not in the ether.
No, at the end of the second section here, there are a whole list of case studies. And maybe we can all have a look at these case studies, because they're all rather problematical to find from the point of view of the halacha. You see it on page 940?
Mm-hmm.
On the bottom, appendix, case studies for task two. Maybe we should get the doctors to give us some instruction here.
Yeah.
And we'll discuss some of that next week. I mean, a lot of these issues are so completely modern that standard halakhic techniques don't easily apply. So right, so they give you about, I don't know, 10 case studies, and they're all interesting.
Task Force 1.
Task Force 2. I'm interested in Task Force 2. End of life problems, basically. All right? The one thing that I do want to go through is a very compassionate Tshuva of the Marsham. I don't know whether we could be studying this Tshuva of the Marsham when we were discussing this before. This is on the issue of those people who actually do take their own lives as a result of pain and suffering at the end of the study. We did? All right. All right, then we don't have to read it again.
Yeah.
It's it's in the record. You can read it for yourselves. And
what?
Never mind what he says. He's not going to give it to it. Do you want to tell it?
מכתבו הגיעני ועל דבר שאלתו ומה שאירה במחניכם כמה מקרים באנשים רמי מעלה אשר בכדי להיפטר מצער ויסורים בעוני וביזיון ידעו את עצמם לדעת רחמנו לצלן אם דינם לכל דבר כמתו על מיטתיו ואין מונים מהם כל דבר. People who committed suicide as a result of depression brought upon by various circumstances, pain and suffering, or sudden economic loss, or what have you, do we treat them according to the rigid rules of suicide, which means that we don't bury them in the regular, etc. That he, Shaul committed suicide, since you know he was certainly going to die anyway, and therefore he was allowed, since it was a matter of simply cutting short a life which was definitely coming to an end, he wanted to avoid the torture that would be put on him by the Plishtim. The im asakein mitnei yisurim ukedome, eino bechlal ma'aved et atzmo ledaat. Ukemasher heiri, gam shelet b'shuvat parshat Mordechai, elak ken, the nehida asur al pi din, even though it's certainly prohibited to take any action which speeds in the end of life. Mikol makon mechshav ka'omer mutar. It's as if someone committed a crime thinking that it was permissible, even though it truly wasn't. The lav kuli alma dini gmiri. Not everybody is aware of the law that even under extreme circumstances one is not to make and take an active act. And the shogei kuayin shemu. V'zen nistar ma shekatav ha-chatam soter yodeh sim shim chata be'emtza ha-tshuva ra'aya. I don't know what that is. V'yavuzer daf yudchet. V'rochanen v'targion v'yavuzer daf yudchet. V'adai lo ratza lasod ken. There's a famous case of a person who was burnt at the stake and refused to allow the water to the Vadai Lord Salim Kamukenu Bakal Mabed Tusratbahana, because he was a scholar and knew the rules, but the ordinary man who's in pain and suffering may not know or may have forgotten it is. גדולה מזו מבואה בבישס רבו, הרי בכיוון שחשבו לנורד במלכות, אם אתם ראו כמת וישתם מותרת וצד וזה. אורן, ומה שכתב לעניין המאמר ואת הסודת אין לו חלק ומזה, צד וסוף דבר שיפה כיבד ומלטו לדינה, שאין לאיש כזה דין מעבד את עצמו לדעת, ואין מונים ממנו שום דבר כנראה אופן האטו. So that therefore he's taking a tolerant attitude towards the families of those people who actually do commit suicide as a result of depression caused on by pain, suffering, and illness, even though it's not permissible, we should be lenient and tolerant as far as funeral arrangements are concerned. So next time I would like to have the doctors lead some of the discussion on these moral issues, and then perhaps we should make a review of the attempts of Rav Moshe to deal with many of these issues. He wrote four very long and very thought-out Shavuot in the period between 1972 and 1985, which are reproduced here, and many of the things that he said we may not agree with, and many of the things that he said are out of date, but nevertheless, at least it was an attempt on his part, and one of our great poskim.
If he's a Talmid Chacham and he knows the laws, it's
more serious.
It was that from the last year?